Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're looking into whether making greener lifestyle choices must come with a cost, and more specifically, whether the cost of living crisis has forced consumers to act less sustainably. There's tons of research out there on how cost-effective sustainability can be. Some say sustainability saves money, but others complain that eco-friendly products are just too expensive. The Independent newspaper says that 6 out of 10 shoppers admit to making less sustainable choices during the economic crisis due to costs. So what's the truth in all of this? And how do we all, consumers and producers alike, arrive at a more sustainable future? Well, with me to discuss this are three absolutely fantastic guests. Aoife Allen is a director of Hubbub, an environmental organisation dedicated to inspiring more sustainable ways of living. Hello there, Aoife.
Hi, Stefan. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. Jonathan Hall is managing partner of the sustainable transformation practice at data analysis company Kantar. Hello, Jonathan.
Morning, Stefan. Great to be here.
Great to have you as well. And we also have Kate Mesher. She's a researcher at the market research company Ipsos UK. Hello, Kate.
Hiya. Good to be here.
Great to have all of you together on the podcast. Now, Kate, let's start with you. We know that sustainability is a moral responsibility, but it's also a marketing tool for businesses wanting to stand out as better than their competitors. You know, this much we know, but how tangibly important is sustainability to consumers?
So it depends how we define importance, I think. So if we're thinking about how concerned people are generally about climate change, it's pretty high. Around, as of August last year, around 8 in 10 people said they were concerned about climate change. Yeah. And kind of our recent rankings of different things people are concerned about, even in the context of the cost of living crisis with strikes and all of that, climate change still ranks 5th of the things people are most concerned about in the UK at the moment. And thinking about food as well, people are thinking about sustainability when it comes to their diets. So around, I think, 6 in 10 said it's important for people to change their diets to be more sustainable. So it's definitely something that people are worried about and think is important.
So I guess that's easily said, though, isn't it? You know, if somebody said to me, is this important to you? I said, yeah. The question really is, am I willing to act on that? And do we, I mean, is there a middle ground where we don't really know? We just assume that people act on the fact that they say it's important, Kate? Or is there research around that says, OK, they will actively make a tangible decision to change?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. There is a gap between people's intentions to change and the extent to which we actually see people making behaviour changes. And even just the kind of, I think, phrasing of questions can change how much people think they're going to change. So there was the 6 in 10 people said that it's important for people to change their diets to help limit the effects of climate change. But when it was phrased slightly differently, so when we asked whether people would be willing to pay more for food if it had less to no impact, but then personally, if it had less impact on the planet, it went down to around 4 in 10, so 41%. So there was a...
Real people are so annoying, aren't they?
Yeah, so there is, we do see a gap. I think, I mean, people generally call it kind of the say-do gap between what people say they're going to do versus the behaviours they actually do.
Yeah, can I just build on Kate's point, Seg? I mean, he's absolutely spot on. What I would say, though, is that I think people are looking for help. So I think, you know, you can't just say, you know, people are well-intentioned, but actually they don't deliver. I mean, that's true to some degree, but actually they really, really want help. And there are very significant barriers which brands and businesses and governments can help them overcome. It's not as if they're just saying this to virtue signal. They're really looking for assistance, and there are concrete things which businesses can do to help them.
And what are those barriers? Is there a sort of scale of importance of those barriers?
Yeah, I mean, Kate may have a point of view on this. I think they're pretty consistent across categories and sectors, from things like convenience, price. We'll come on to talk about price, I'm sure, in relation to the cost of living crisis. The sort of price quality equation, awareness, sense of individual responsibility versus a brand or government. So there are lots of barriers. And then what you just need to do is think, okay, how do those apply to my sector or category if I'm a business or brand?
Yeah. And Jonathan, I mean, the cost of living crisis is, well, lots of people have always been in a cost of living crisis, but it's pretty acute at the moment. Has this changed any of the research, any of the numbers that you've crunched on sustainable choices?
Yeah, I mean, Kate started to touch on this. I think there's decades of data to show that these things are important to people. I think we've seen an acceleration over the last 10, 5, 2 years. And then when we look at the various crises we've been going through, Kantar runs what we call a global issues barometer. So it started looking through COVID and has gone on through the war in Ukraine and the cost of living crisis. And what we actually see is that people's views with regard to social and environmental issues are actually hardening rather than reducing. So people are becoming increasingly concerned. And I think our last wave, we saw that climate was number 2, social problems number 3. Just behind issues with regard to inflation. And not only that, but when we asked them, you know, about the relative importance, as many as 49% of people said that sustainability issues have become more important to them, and a further 44% said equally important. And you know, this isn't just in the UK, it's across the world. And I think the thing to remember here is that people feel this at a very personal level. We see increasing levels of stress, in literally across Latin America, through Africa, through to Asia. We see in the Middle East and Africa, for example, because people are experiencing significant disruption from climate change, that personal experience is in turn framing their realities. And they're also demanding action. So looking for action with regard to natural resources, you know, loss of biodiversity and so on. And so finally, what we see is that nearly 70% of people saying we mustn't allow the current situation that we're in, the cost of living crisis, worsen the climate crisis. So, you know, over 70% of people globally are looking for action on these issues. So far from it reducing, we'll talk about price, I'm sure, and the cost of living shortly in more detail. But overall, these are issues which are going to become increasingly important.
This is a really interesting idea, isn't it? So Aoife, this idea that Jonathan talked about of stress, I mean, I guess there's tangible stress in certain areas of the world where there is change that we can see. And then there's something that I've noticed a lot more of recently, of parents like me talking about their kids having climate anxiety. Now, it's an empathic idea, really, isn't it? Because the UK experiences less climate change than lots of areas around the world. So this is about perception, I suppose, isn't it? And how powerful are these different issues? Is there a difference between seeing and experiencing change and thinking about change around the world and being part of that?
I don't think in the UK we're immune to seeing change. We saw a heat wave last year that saw temperatures breaching 40 degrees in London, and, you know, critical infrastructure broke down, from systems within hospitals through to railway services, etc., and my own laptop just collapsed in the heat. A very personal experience of it. So it's, I think, in the last 18 months or so, we've seen climate change actually land on our doorsteps, and the climate crisis land on our doorsteps to an extent, causing, I would say, significant climate anxiety amongst children and adults alike. It mightn't be as threatening yet to our livelihoods as people in other parts of the world seeing consistent flooding, for example, might experience. But it's certainly, I think, the combination of the 24-hour news cycle, social media, a lot of noise on this topic, and then just the reality of the climate crisis landing our doorsteps is having a massive, I suppose, a massive impact on awareness, with the benefits that people are more likely and willing to take action, but also that factor of perhaps a feeling of helplessness, potentially amongst younger cohorts too. At Hubbub, our objective is to make climate action easy and accessible. So we're always looking to the positive. How can people make changes that would perhaps help them save money as well, or help them save time, be better for the health, and also have a positive environmental impact? And we feel that that's one of the ways we can soften that blow of climate anxiety, if we offer tangible actions that people can take rather than focusing on perhaps the more kind of big picture impact.
Yeah. And Kate, before we delve into the sort of the complications of and the ramifications of all this in the food world, have we covered everything? Are there other factors that maybe contribute to consumers making less sustainable choices? So we've gone through convenience and price and awareness. I mean, there are other issues as well, I guess, aren't there?
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll talk about it more in the context of the cost of living crisis, but cost is absolutely a really big one in terms of people either perceiving it to be a barrier or it being a very real barrier that people can't get past. But then also, as kind of as Jonathan mentioned, around people wanting to know what they can do, there is a gap or a barrier in place in how much impact people perceive their actions as having.
Okay, yeah.
So there's, I mean, firstly, people tend to overestimate the actions that have less impact. So people will emphasize recycling, wasting less, as having more impact than behaviors like having a vegan diet, for example. Mm-hmm. People will rank recycling much higher than they will rank having a vegan diet because of misconceptions around the impact of doing so on the planet. And I think it is going down a little bit, but there's also a sense of, well, how much can my personal actions really have an impact?
Yeah.
So we did some polling late last year, and it found that roughly a fifth of people said, what's the point in me taking action, essentially? Like, yeah. They said they agreed that there was no point in changing their behavior to tackle climate change because it won't make a difference anyway. So, you know, that's not a majority.
Wow.
But
and that's a high percentage, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a large minority of people saying that.
Yeah. Okay, let's get into the detail a little bit then. So if when it comes to sustainability, we often hear the importance of eating more plant-based diet, as Kate just said. But a study in the Times found that meat alternative products cost more by an average of 11%. Now, I guess this is quite difficult to unfold the research on this. But is sustainable food always more expensive?
I think it's only more expensive if we define or interpret it in the narrowest possible sense. Mm. So I think we have a bit of a problem when it comes to food around framing of sustainability. The concept has gone mainstream. People are talking about sustainability a lot more than they were when Hubbub started out in 2014, for example. But elements of sustainability, as it were, have been commercialized, and that's creating some confusion around what a sustainable diet is. So I think a good definition of a sustainable diet is one that's low in meat and dairy, if not completely leaving it out, and high in whole foods. It also includes buying only what you need and eating all that you buy. So cutting out food waste at home is a way to have a sustainable diet, and cooking efficiently. So the impact of how you cook your food is part of the overall sustainability package, the emissions that come from your cooking. And if you look at my definition, I guess, or, well, it's not mine, but that kind of broadly accepted definition beyond commercially sustainable products, those are all money savers. So if you eat everything that you buy and only buy what you need, that will save you money. If you cook efficiently, that will reduce your energy bills. And if you eat more whole foods and less meat and dairy, it's likely that that's going to save you money too.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it can be a very affordable diet to follow if you go for a more sustainable approach. I do think that some of the sustainable products are pioneers, by the way. I think they're making incredible strides in the food space, in the food product space. But I don't think it's realistic.
And pioneering and innovation is an expensive affair, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, they're innovating all the time. They're developing more and more accessible products so that you'll have increased likelihood of people who enjoy meat taking on those products one or two meals a week. But it's not realistic to think that the typical household in the UK is going to buy, you know, 5 meals worth of alternative meat burgers for a week. A more accessible and likely approach for them to have a sustainable diet is to sub in pulses, tinned pulses or frozen foods, and reduce their meat by half. So, you know, a tin of chickpeas, own brand at the moment, costs between 50 and 70p. You could sub out half the chicken in a curry and sub in that tin of chickpeas and probably not offend too many people around the table.
Apart from my daughter, Poppy, probably stabbed
Apart
me.
From your daughter. Yeah. You can't please everyone, but there are lots of
Absolutely.
You know, quick, easy fixes that you can sub into the typical favourite meals across the typical repertoire.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And make that a more sustainable meal in the process.
Yeah. Now, Jonathan, I mean, both Aoife and Kate have mentioned about sort of the complexities and the confusion of consumers and the different choices they make and the interconnectivity of their sustainability choices. Do you think that we're still at a very early stage of understanding that and explaining that to consumers? And is there a point at which maybe this will all be a little bit clearer?
Well, I think it's certainly not the responsibility of consumers. So what we find is that people are getting increasingly resentful with regard to the amount of responsibility that's being assigned to them by corporations. And obviously, there are certain sectors and there are certain businesses in whose interest it is to try and push the responsibility onto consumers. But I think we are increasingly seeing a backlash against that.
What form does that backlash take, would you say?
Well, I think at the moment, we're certainly seeing it more at a level of, you know, when we're speaking to them, both in more qualitative, like focus group or interview situations, or then we're seeing that when you look at the analysis of search and social data, you're seeing conversations increasing in this area. And I think what will happen is that we'll see increasing action from citizen action groups with regard to these sorts of corporate action. And, you know, as we've seen, you know, anything up to accusations of greenwashing through to, you know, even legal action against corporates in certain areas, then I think we'll see increasing activism with regard to businesses in this space that increasingly try to do that. I think the more far-sighted businesses will not try to do that. They'll try and engage, and their narrative will be more about a sense of collective endeavour. And I think people will be much more open to that and want to engage with those businesses that do.
Could I build on that point and just mention that I think sustainability when it comes to food is phenomenally complex, and asking the consumer or the shopper, the buyer, however you want to describe them, to interpret greenhouse gas emissions, water use, land use, storage and transportation, nature loss, pesticides, food inputs, etc., is totally unfair. I think there are a lot of businesses that are trying really hard to communicate their footprint at the moment, and I applaud that. But there are lots of aspects to consider, more than I've just listed now. And you can either overload or oversimplify if you try to capture everything at a glance. So I think, again, as a consumer of food, I think getting a simple, unified message out there that a sustainable diet is that one where you nudge down meat and dairy consumption and nudge up kind of whole healthy affordable foods is probably the simplest way to talk about this topic. We speak to a lot of people in the sector on a regular basis, and I know that this is probably the most contentious sustainability issue there is, because there are so many inputs and outputs of food production, necessarily so in a lot of cases, but it puts a phenomenal burden on the consumers to try and get their head around that. You know, I find it challenging, and I live and breathe this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So sustainability standards and how to inform the consumer. I mean, should there be a council of sustainability that does a traffic light system to try and build this together? And we know that traffic light systems are complex with nutrition. But at the moment, it's a bit of a minefield. There are so many sort of, you know, conflations of different issues that blend together, and you can't make the decision. So is there progress on some sort of standards about assumptions of sustainability? And until we get that, how can consumers really trust what they're buying?
I personally think one of the better standards, nothing's perfect, but the MSC certification is useful, mm-hmm. because they update their information very regularly if the consumer is interested to peer behind the label and understand how those decisions are made. They have good transparency for purchasing fish. Other certifications such as B Corp status can be useful. There's good data behind that thinking, and it covers social and governance as well as environmental. I mean, the jury remains out on labelling. Having three or four different labels across nutrition, carbon, etc., could become complex for the consumer. And as I mentioned earlier, you could develop something that's quite complex and overload, or you could develop something that's overly simplifies and leaves out some really key considerations. So I think getting the formula right is really critical, and then having accessible, transparent information behind the label on a website or such for the particularly engaged or interested buyer may be a way to go. I know there are lots of different organisations testing this at the moment, and I don't think we've quite landed on the right formula just yet, but it feels like a good step in the right direction.
Yeah. Jonathan, do you think that standardised sustainability information on packaging is either likely or feasible?
Yeah, it's interesting, just reflecting what Aoife was saying, and I'd love her point of view on what I'm going to say, which is, I think, again, there's a responsibility on the part of brands to be involved in this and communicate in a way which is going to make things meaningful for people. Because when we look at the current situation, consumers just are totally confused, and it is a complete soup of accreditation, which they don't understand, they switch off, and they don't trust. And we've all seen the documentaries as well, which make that situation worse. And I think even though there are going to be suspicions of greenwashing there's going to be cynicism with regard to brand actions in the social environmental space. Nevertheless, I think brands need to follow through and work with, if it is working with accreditation councils, then all the better. But to make something which is an industry-wide standard, they partner together and they communicate it, use their marketing communication skills to actually get the message over to people and simplify it for people, because otherwise we won't make any progress.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, Aoife, slightly different subject to talk about, but what are the other elements of perception versus reality? Is sustainability conflated with things like a lack of flavour? You know, to be honest, certainly 5 years ago, lots of vegan food I tasted were trying to bundle too many positives together, and for instance, they'd be lacking in salt. Now, I know that salt's a pariah, but you know, if you don't have it, then things aren't going to taste good enough. Do you think that there is a flavour perception as well as the cost and sheer lack of trust?
I think in terms of like plant-based meat alternatives, there have been unbelievable strides in the last couple of years in terms of taste. And I think we're seeing some clever marketing occurring with some of the major innovative brands I've mentioned earlier, where you see that those food products moving out of the sort of vegan space into much more mainstream. We're starting to see some of those plant-based burger patties, for example, appearing on some of the high street burger chains. They're all really, really positive steps in the right direction. So I do think that plant alternatives or meat alternatives are starting to cast off that perception of being unappealing or for an incredibly fringe element in society, and all those old ideas that we saw knocking around for a long time, where you had to go to almost a health food store or even a pharmacist to buy your vegan food. I noticed last week in Morrison's, there's a large one at the end of my street, that they've moved all of their plant-based product into the meat aisle, as it were. So there's a section at the beginning of the meat aisle. That's another sign that this is becoming a sort of a mainstream offer and a mainstream product that people are comfortable to browse alongside their pork sausages. They can choose their this sausages as an alternative, and they're probably going to taste roughly the same. So again, I do feel that there's huge innovation in that space, which is really exciting. And it's appearing on menus at football matches. It's appearing on high street burger chains. It's appearing in pizza chains, etc. And that is how you, one of the ways that we can move the dial a bit on plant-based diets.
I think the media coverage of the Greggs vegan sausage roll was
phenomenal.
Was the impact of that was vast in so many different areas, wasn't it?
Yeah, fabulous marketing for Greggs, and I think it was a bit of a sea change in how we think about these very typical snack foods that have always been meat based in the past. I think one of the limitations that we're seeing at the moment is that those businesses haven't quite found yet how to move it from the sort of treat snack type foods, burgers, chicken nuggets and sausages all lend themselves very well to those meat alternatives. They haven't quite found the way yet to turn it into the more every meal during the week offer. So that's where one of the challenges are. And I think that's the next one for the industry at the moment, to come up with the steak or the chicken breast. That is something that the kids will eat and that everybody's comfortable.
Properly dirty burger. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So, Kate, so that's about flavour and perceptions of flavour. What about the reality between sort of perception and reality of the cost? Now, people think that sustainable means it's more expensive. Is that borne out by what's out there, do you think?
There is a perception, really, that plant-based or sustainability in general is more expensive. It's, I think, 35% said they were too worried about the cost of living to think about climate change, although more people did disagree. So, and when it comes to policies as well around sustainability, people much prefer the policies that will cost them less than will cost them more, perhaps unsurprisingly. But importantly, though, I think the public doesn't see an inherent trade-off between sustainability and the cost, despite the current context. So this is remaining quite consistent in the data that we have from prior to the cost of living to now. So I think it was 6 in 10 agreed that when they were making changes to try and save money, they would try and make changes that wouldn't negatively impact the environment. And the UK public also disagreed with the statement that now isn't the right time to be addressing climate change, with 4 in 10 disagreeing that that statement wasn't true and essentially saying, yes, we should still be addressing climate change despite economic difficulties. So I think there is a perception that it can be more expensive, particularly when people are thinking more generally about products. So, you know, if we're thinking about plant-based burgers, for example, they tend to be more expensive per unit than beef burgers often. But if we're thinking, as Aoife has mentioned, if we're thinking about chickpeas versus chopping up some chicken for a curry, chickpeas are cheaper.
And packed full of protein as well. So, Jonathan, I'm interested in the sort of demographic split of this, because I remember being on the dole and the idea of you know, paying extra for a product that was organic. It was almost laughable. You know, it simply wasn't possible. We recently did a poll on the Food Matters Live LinkedIn page. Now, I'm not saying this is industry standard research, but we asked our readers the simple question: what's more important, sustainability or price? And by the way, thank you so much to everyone who voted on that. It's great to hear from you all. It was a very even split. 51% that price was more important. 49% said sustainability. Now, it's a simple question, I guess, right? And the complications are endless. But it got us thinking about demographics and people engaging with our content on LinkedIn will have certain interests and work in certain sectors. Are there demographic splits when it comes to questions of sustainability and the cost of living? Does everyone care as much as everyone else, and it's just the ability to pay for that care?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I guess there are two parts to it on that. First of all, is there a demographic split? And then what are the implications of that? I mean, I think, so when we look at our various data sources, certainly, and it will come as no surprise, it is younger cohorts who both consider themselves to be more environmentally and socially oriented, and also those who actually see sustainability as being a marker of their social identity, so, you know, expresses who they are. And that, so for millennials, they are over-indexing enormously on both of those. And I think we need to see that it's the younger millennials who are blazing the trail here. And then, but then rapidly coming in behind are the Gen Zers, obviously the largest cohort we've ever seen. And they are fundamentally changing society. And that sounds like a big statement. And I think people need to let that sink in, because we do a lot of generational work. And if you look at the last 120 years, there's only been one comparable shift within the makeup of society and the values that go with it. And that, of course, was after the Second World War, when we saw a shift from institutionalism to a sense of individualism and the release of wealth driven by the boomer cohort. And brands like, you know, typically Harley Davidson and Levi's capitalized upon that by embracing those values. We are going through the same pivot at this point, and we'll see a shift from fundamental individualism to that greater sense of, you know, community and sustainability. And the businesses and brands that align themselves with that value shift will be the ones which win in the marketplace. Of that, we are absolutely sure. So I think, yes, there's a huge fundamental demographic shift. I think, coming back to the point you're making before about price, of course, one of the big barriers that we've talked about already is the cost to younger consumers, because they simply can't afford. But you know what? That's a challenge right across the piece. And we, when we look globally, 2/3 of the world's population is in a similar boat. They are not in the sort of more active, wealthier segment who can, you know, who are more engaged, but can also afford to be more engaged. What that suggests is that there is a huge opportunity. So while sustainability is seen as being a luxury of the wealthier, and recent analysis suggests that in some markets, organizations are charging 200% premium on the, you know, on their more mainstream non-sustainable product lines. So those perceptions are absolutely borne out. Nevertheless, there is a huge opportunity for a lower cost, more mainstreamed offering. And again, the businesses and brands that do that are going to benefit not only today, but to come back to your question, they will benefit tomorrow because of the younger millennials and the Gen Zers who are going to drive those sorts of values in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Kate, Jonathan mentioned something else earlier on, which is about sort of the questions of responsibility. And I guess it's, we might all have our own personal views on this, but what do consumers think? Do consumers feel that they are empowered to make sustainable choices? Do they see it as their problem, or do they see that they need, you know, that it's big business's problem or a governmental issue, and therefore who should really take the hit for it?
Interestingly, it's from recent data we've got, it's actually a fairly even split. So roughly the same proportions, around two-thirds, said that if individuals didn't act now to combat climate change, they'll be failing future generations. And if businesses didn't act now, they would be failing their employees and customers. And if the government doesn't act now to combat climate change, it would be failing British citizens. Mm-hmm. And kind of globally, it's relatively similar with some fluctuations in some markets. But I think people do tend to see the government as being slightly more responsible. So 79%, so 8 in 10, said that the government bore a great deal or a fair amount of responsibility for reducing carbon emissions. But again, a similar proportion said the same for businesses and the public. So there is a sense of quite shared responsibility, I think. But in some research that we've done qualitatively, we have found that people tend to want government to kind of set the roadmaps and then for other actors to then take responsibility for the actions that they've been given.
Yeah.
But yeah, from a quantitative standpoint, we do see people seeing a sense of shared responsibility across society.
And Aoife, there's a complication here, isn't there? Because the food, retail and agricultural industries, they're ranked amongst the most environmentally harmful of all industries on the planet. Why would it be down to individual consumers to make changes and to pay for those changes when there's so much to be done at the industry level?
I don't think it's an either-or scenario. Everybody needs to change. And we're all part of the same system, as it were. You know, consumers at the end of the food system, or those who produce it, are all kind of part of the same process. And we mustn't underestimate the wishes of the public and their desire and willingness to play their part. We know from some government public attitudes tracking that about 85% of people think that individual behaviour change has a role to play in combating the climate crisis. And we've seen people's really positive environmental behaviour shifts over the years. So, for example, you know, recycling is a mainstream household habit and practice now. It's been enabled by structural change, but that's something that people are happy to do. They don't have to do it, but they're happy to do it and they think it's the right thing to do. So while the bulk of responsibility sits with industry and the governments that kind of enable their operations, people also have an individual responsibility to the environment and themselves. And on the food side of things, there are lots of complexities that we've spoken to, but actually food is the one place where you can actually make 3 to 5 changes a day and one big change a week when you shop or however often you undertake your weekly shop. So it is an easy place to start. And if we can get past the complexity of the messaging about what a sustainable diet actually is and pull discussions around meat and dairy out of the so-called culture war space, I think we can really equip people to make those changes a number of times a day and with their kind of purchasing power. I also think that very often the public is a little bit ahead of where industry might think they are. We've done some really great in-depth sort of social listening and research with cohorts of different age groups, different demographics. And we hear that they're absolutely intrigued by the idea of eating a more low impact diet and just want to know how to do that. They're looking for that clarity and not masses and masses of complexity that would make it more difficult for them to move forward with a more sustainable diet.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, I've got one last question for all of you. And because you've all been so fantastic about talking about the issues, let's talk about you instead. So my last question really is, to all of you, is what's the one thing you've either recently implemented into your life or that you're most excited about seeing in the sustainability world to make things better on a level that you can actually grasp yourselves? What can you do and what are you excited about? So, Kate, what sort of sustainable changes do you think are available to you and that you have done or that you'd like to make?
Well, one thing that I've done actually quite recently was change my pension to a sustainable pension. So it's investing
only
sustainable businesses, which
I think
apparently
a wise financial choice as well, to be honest.
I know. It's one of my first kind of big financial things. Yeah, it apparently has a really big impact. And because it's tacit, it's not something I'm personally needing to do. It's kind of a one-time thing that I've now changed it. That's quite exciting that's open.
That's brilliant. I wasn't expecting that at all, but absolutely brilliant answer. Thank you for that. Jonathan, what about you? Recent implementations or something that you're particularly excited about being able to do?
I mean, like all of us, I think over the past few years, in particular with COVID, I've been cutting down on things and cutting out and stopping or reducing doing things. So plastics and flights and certain types of food, clothes and getting rid of our car and so on, which is all good and important. But I think it's also, in order to drive the mainstreaming of sustainability that we've been discussing today, then I think we've got to move the message on to a much more positive story as well. So, You know, we're lucky enough to be able to afford to have solar panels installed. And over the summer, they were providing three times as much electricity as we needed, even on days like today in the depths of winter. As soon as the sun shined, they're providing electricity. And we've had, you know, amazing tasting non-dairy ice cream. And at work, we use food waste-based catering. And, you know, I've been indulging in secondhand clothing. And I think none of this is about cutting out. It's fun, it's inspiring, it's delicious, and I know it's critical going forward.
I love, yeah, okay. So the optimism, the positivity is the implementation. That's fantastic. Aoife, how about you? Something you've implemented or something you're excited to be able to do?
I feel like Jonathan has stolen my spiel. I completely agree
good,
on that
it?
Positivity,
yeah. Kate,
yeah. The money saving, the fun that can be, and, you know, tastiness that can be part of making more sustainable choices. Something that I'm quite committed to at the moment and have been for about a year or so is just not really buying any new clothing apart from the absolute fundamentals that need to be bought new. And my partner and I have decided now not to fly for holidays again. So we haven't done that in a while, obviously, due to the pandemic. We're taking the train to Berlin and Amsterdam on Thursday for a nice long weekend. Plenty of travel, but it should be very enjoyable. And we want to just kind of commit to living our values in that sense. One other thing I would recommend is having only oat milk in your house and forcing it on your guests if they come around for coffee, because a lot of people ultimately prefer the taste. And it can be a nice little
Brooke,
nudge.
Brooke, no dissent. I like
yes,
that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, quite right. So, well, they're all fantastic ideas. Well, also, the three key issues that have come out of this for me are the accreditation or simplifying the issues for consumers is really important. Investing in young consumers' concerns was a really interesting idea. And thirdly, that it's a really big shared responsibility. I think that was a brilliant rundown of all of the facts of what's going on with sustainability and the consumer at the moment. So Aoife Allen, Jonathan Hall and Kate Mesher, thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. If you're a business in the food and drink industry with a story to tell, we can help you tell it. We have partnership opportunities available using the podcast medium to bring those stories to life. You can join the likes of Givaudan, Kerry Group, Kellogg's and Anglo American and be part of the Food Matters Live community, inspiring the future of food. To find out more, go online and search Food Matters Live podcast partnerships or email us direct on info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.